Intervju Radija Študent.
Pozdravljeni v Eriš intervjuju. Tokrat malo drugače kot sicer, drugače v tem pogledu, da ponavadi intervjuje delamo pred koncerti tistih zased ali pa avtorjev, ki jih predstavljamo v intervjuju. Tokrat bo drugače, ker smo imeli v torek in pa sredo zasedena termina za intervju. Predstavljamo namreč danes zasedbo Danex, ki je nastopila v torek v kinu Šiška. Zelo priljubljena avstralska zasedba. V intervjuju so se nam pridružili vsi trije člani, se pravi Tony, Lloyd in pa Chris. So povedali precej zanimivih stvari od njihovih začetkov, torej začeli so že tam pred 25 leti, pa tudi do tega, kako so percepirani danes znotraj jazza, pa tudi mogoče improvizirane muzike. Povedali so, ki oni vidijo razloge za vzpon improvizirane glasbe v Avstraliji tam v zadnjih 10 letih približno ali pa malo več. O svoji glasbi, kjer je album vsem najljubši in podobne stvari, tako da bomo kar slišati posnetek.
You know, given that 25 years have passed since the, you started, did you imagine at that time the possibility you'd still be playing together after all these years? You know, how ambitious were you back then in terms of the future of the band? Were you thinking about that?
We were very unambitious. We formed the band originally to play in private, and we did not intend to perform to the public at all, and we spent about 6 months doing that before we played in public. And then even when we did start playing in public, we really just did 2 or 3 shows a year, and then Tony moved overseas, which made it difficult for us to get together for concerts. But just gradually we began performing more and more, and where the band is now is it would be a complete surprise to us from 25 years ago. Absolutely wasn't something we ever imagined.
Tony, when did you move overseas? Was this in the 90s already? Was it in the 90s already or later?
Yeah, I moved to Japan in 1991.
So that was like 4 years after you started?
Yeah.
So what happened with Next would be a bit different if you still stayed in Australia, maybe.
That's possible. I think one thing that it did was make us make the most of the time we had when we were all together, and kind of timetable in recording and playing gigs. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it was, I think we were more efficient with our time than if we had all lived together in the same country or city and kind of did gigs here and there and drips and drabs. I think it made us a little focused on time.
Mm-hmm. Also, once it was clear from our intense workshopping that we had a pretty good system of making music that usually worked, we didn't need to rehearse anymore. And because it's completely improvised, we know, even from an early stage, we realized we can go away to different parts of the world and come back together and mm-hmm. and play like we haven't been apart. Mm-hmm. So that's been a principle ever since, that we haven't rehearsed since that first 6 month period in 1980.
And how much were you rehearsing at that time, in those 6 months? Like every day?
My memory was 2 or 3 times a week.
Yeah, we were quite consistent 2 or 3 times a week, I'd say.
You know, the way music changed or developed, it would make sense to say that you were considered to be more like dissidents back then. And nowadays it seems that people are much more open towards the music that, you know, can be fitted into a certain box. Do you feel this on a, like, totally practical level? You know, did you think your music would get near as much approval as it has today?
Again, I think it's a real surprise to us. We didn't necessarily think that our music had no commercial potential, but it simply wasn't an issue that we considered in the early stages. Mm-hmm. I do recall there was a certain bemusement from some people that we played such long improvisations. A lot of people joked after 10 or 15 minutes, they say, okay, you've played the intro, when's the tune starting? And then, mm-hmm. you know, that was a common joke.
I think it's delicious.
Yeah, well, now, but I think we were kind of fortunate that there was a worldwide trance movement. It just became much more accepted and normal for people to play on, you know, one tonality for a long period of time, and all of a sudden we didn't look so strange anymore.
Mm-hmm. Because I know that you got quite a few awards, especially in Australia. Mm. When did these awards start coming in? Was it soon after you started?
No, I think the mid-90s maybe, so maybe after 10 years or so.
It seems some relevant writers about music in traditional American jazz community still seem to be quite dismissive, you know, to put it mildly, about your music. I'm obviously referring to John Littweiler and what he wrote about one of your gigs. I think, Lloyd, you responded to him about this.
It's famous. Swanton response.
And this to me is really seems more as a compliment, you know, that these institutions, traditional jazz institutions, don't accept you. But given that you all have partly a jazz background, or love for jazz music, how much were you really counting on being accepted by the jazz community when you first started?
I'm not surprised that John didn't really like what we did. I mean, I think it came as a... Yeah, I mean, I think we all met when we were really into modern jazz, particularly kind of 60s mm-hmm. American modern jazz. But I think, in a way, the formation of the Next, the actual formation of the band, was about sort of trying to break away from that. And I mean, you can't help how people conceive of you, but I've always thought, you know, I mean, I'm not denying that we were, you know, and still are, really love that sort of music. Mm-hmm. But it does seem if people come and approach us with a particular mindset or a set of things that they're expecting to hear, there is a risk that they would be disappointed. And I think that is a shame. I mean, mm-hmm. if people come along to a Next show expecting, you know, sparkling solos, you know, sort of traditional jazz setting, and I mean, they can get, we don't actually want to display that sort of facile virtuosity mm-hmm. to a certain, to, I mean, from myself anyway, I would see it as a display of virtuosity. And I think the actual, you know, meaning of why we formed the band was to sort of get away from that.
Like to say, it was, I had no problem with John Littweiler not liking us. It was his method that he mm-hmm. chose for criticising us that I thought was very unfair, and I think he prejudged us. His review conveyed a sense to me that he'd already decided not to like us, and maybe he would say that's unfair that he claims he came with an open mind, but it didn't sound like that the way. But the other thing I'd also like to say is I would disagree that disapproval from the jazz community is a badge of pride for us. I don't think we're trying to deliberately piss off anyone.
I think we'd like it if everyone liked it.
Yeah, we like an openness about our music and would like people to judge it on its merits. And if they don't like it, that's fine, but we certainly aren't mm-hmm. trying to offend anyone.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, getting back to the question of are we surprised by people that do like it, the question before, which is interesting. One thing I think that, unlike other bands I play in, with the music of the Next, we kind of present it as like, this is what we do, and I don't think feel that in concerts or when we make records we try to do things to please an audience. I don't think we kind of, I think we're just presenting what, this is it, this is what we're doing, the music, we feel good about it, it's, everything's clear, we're not going to try and shape it to keep it entertaining or make it exciting or try and satisfy any particular audience, which is something quite unique in this band. I think we really feel confident in presenting what we do, but we would really like people to get it.
Mm. I mean, I think when we first started playing, you know, in the prior to playing live, in the very early formation of the band, I think very soon when we started rehearsing, I felt in the music like I was hearing something that was, we were playing in a way I'd never really played before. And it questioned this idea of, you know, a performer is up on stage and is broadcasting to an audience, and it's a one-way thing. Mm-hmm. Up until that point in time, that's how I kind of felt about it, that performance was some sort of display that left the stage and went to the audience. With the Next, for the first time, I felt like I was actually starting to listen to what I was playing. There was a feedback mechanism that, in fact, I became kind of part of the audience, and I was playing things that I was finding exciting. I mean, you may think this is narcissistic or whatever, but it was a real breakthrough for me. And I think up until that point, I'd never really been taken away by music, by playing music that is actually forcing me to make decisions through playing that music, if you know what I mean, a looped feedback sort of situation. Mm-hmm. That's not to say I'm, you know, I don't want to leave the audience out, but I think it's going on with what, you know, Tony's saying is that it's not like we want approval from an audience is why we're doing it. We're actually, right from the word, from the very early days of playing with the group, I was getting something out of it that I'd never gotten out of any other music I'd played before.
I think the reverse is true too. I've obviously never been in the audience at a next gig, but I feel like the audience to some extent feels like they're participating in the creation of the music. And that's what's been wonderful for us, is that after the initial resistance in the very early days where it was a bit strange and exotic for people, that's never been a problem. There's always people in the room that know what we're doing and to some extent help the performance along. Mm-hmm. By their open ears, and I think that's something that people come along to their first ever next show and they're amazed at what they see around them, the sort of attentiveness of the other audience members, and straight away they pick up on that and hear the music in a way that they wouldn't hear in a lot of other concerts.
You know, when I said that you are kind of dismissed from some people from this traditional jazz community, but on the other hand, quite a few of my friends who first visited one of your gigs, the next were kind of their entry point to the world of jazz music, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's probably a compliment as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe just one more question about the States. When did you play your last gig there?
In the United States?
Yeah.
2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that, because in Europe?
Oh, yeah, we were in Philadelphia last year doing the theatre show that we were doing.
Because in Europe, Australia, Scandinavia, UK, things are really opening up for jazz. You know, they are not longer afraid of baroque music or electronic music or pop music being drawn into the jazz idiom. Do you think that in the United States, things are opening up as well lately?
I think they are. I also think it's quite understandable that they have a slightly more possessive interest in maintaining what they perceive as the jazz tradition. But there's
it seems that's doing more harm to the music.
Well, I agree, but I can see why they would do it, you know, because there's very good reasons to want to preserve particular traditions if you're particularly proud of them and you think that they say something positive about your heritage. But I think there's many, many very creative, forward-thinking musicians in America who aren't stuck in that traditionalist mindset, and that's really exciting.
But also, don't you think this jazz music is opening up to other influences and becoming, incorporating fusions of styles as a sort of subject that's been talked about for, you know, 40, 50 years, 60 years, like Cuban.
Yeah, but it was always kind of pushed on the edge.
Sorry?
It wasn't part of the more mainstream kind of jazz,
yeah,
you know, whereas in the recent years, I think especially in the UK, there are lots of bands becoming well-known, even popular, doing this more fusion kind of thing.
Yeah. I don't know, I sort of think that I've heard that as a topic since at least as long as I've been sort of involved in music, different fads come and go, and like, I remember Courtney Pine was going to be the great voice of kind of English jazz, and then there's the dance hall sampling aspect of electronica and jazz, and that was, came and went, and then
acid jazz.
Yeah, acid jazz, and then the jazz dance thing. And in knowing jazz history, like the Cuban influence of Dizzy Gillespie brought, and then the jazz rock thing, Miles Davis.
Bossa Nova.
Bossa Nova. Yeah, it's a sort of an endless kind of like, yeah, now jazz is going to break through to the mainstream. I don't know, it just seems to come in waves up and down. I don't see that it's any different now than it ever has been, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's more conservative elements trying to sort of keep it as a sort of museum piece now.
I would.
Maybe that always existed too.
I think there's a fair argument. There's a greater range of influences. Like previously, it would just be sort of one movement at a time. You know, you'd have the Afro-Cuban thing, but that was, if you looked around, that was about the only thing that was influencing jazz from outside.
It's accumulative after years.
Yeah.
But it doesn't ever go away, and you just add to it.
And
now it's like decades of stuff piled on top.
Yeah, Australian music scene in recent years became well known for the outstanding improvised music, whereas when you started, things were apparently much more kind of conservative. What triggered that, or when did things started to change?
I think if you're talking about people like Jim Denley, for example, I mean, Jim's our age, and I can't remember.
Or maybe some younger guys.
Yeah, I can't remember when a time when Jim wasn't well regarded in Australia for what he does. I mean, he's simply become better known outside Australia now than...
It seems maybe in recent 10 years or so that things really pushed even further up, you know, these young guys coming up, like Room 40. I think one of you was kind of involved in that as well.
And people like Oren Ambachi and...
What do you think kind of influenced all these happenings in this recent or last 10 years or so for Australian improvised music to flourish like this?
Well, I think maybe, you know, possibly...
Do you see it like it happened suddenly, or was it a long process?
I think there's been a big influx of people, young people, interested in improvised music and not necessarily in American modern jazz, so to speak, but also with, you know, European improvising, which when we were young musicians, we there wasn't a great deal of interest in Australia in terms of the European thing. I mean, people like Jim and John Rose and those people sort of were, you know, very one-off people. But I think, you know, there's been a number of courses at universities run by people like, well, there's a guy called Julian Knowles, and he set up a course at the University of Western Sydney, and then you get sort of 20, 30 people doing that, and then a similar thing up in Brisbane. And then, so suddenly you do actually get a lot of people that haven't gone to a kind of straight jazz course, so to speak, or classical music course, but one that's slightly more informed. And I think the internet has had a lot to do with it as well. I think there's much more communication. Airfares are cheaper, so a lot of more people are travelling a lot more, and it's not looked up. I mean, it was looked up. I think it was, you know, safe to say when I was 18, the idea of flying to Europe from Australia was huge. You know? I mean, it's still a big thing, but I don't think it's anywhere near as, you know, people can kind of come and go.
And technology has made the sound generating much more portable. You know, you can travel with a laptop now, where previously an improviser would have had to take a road case full of all manner of homemade instruments and the like.
And I think counterintuitively, with the sort of demise of CD sales, there's been a sort of blossoming of CD production. So a lot of people making a lot of records and you know, releasing them on little labels. So I think there's a lot more communication going on. So Australia maybe isn't quite as isolated as it was in the 70s.
And I think there's a lot of interesting elements of creative music that have, since the 80s and post-punk era, come from places that aren't driven by, like Chris said, the American model. So you get like people influenced by noise music and alternative rock music and new classical music and interactions. And there were festivals in Australia like What Is Music, I think was very...
It started in the 80s already, or was it later?
I think it probably started in the 90s. But it brought influences from very contrasting styles and approaches to music together, and like presented them in ways that were kind of equal as far as a sort of appreciation of what they had to offer artistically. And that, I think, really inspired some younger people who may not have been drawn to a jazz model at all. And then there were noise and rock models and new music models being...
What was your academic experience like for you three? Were you exposed to this more open music at that time, or
well,
it was still very traditional?
All three of us did a course at the CURS, the Conservatorium of Music in New South Wales, which was jazz-based. And there were some teachers that in there that had adventurous approaches to music. But given they were a generation younger than us, what they were exposed to themselves was quite limited and often also based on these American jazz models, because, I mean, it was a jazz course, so that's fair enough. But, yeah, the more eclectic and other sources of creative, experimental and adventurous music, be it John Cage or Cornelius Cardew or Pierre Henry, was like really... Yeah. They weren't really in the vision of people that were teaching us or what we were exposed to.
I mean, I think, you know, the term sort of American model, I mean, I think we're referring mainly to, like, bebop. I mean, I think, you know, it's clear, like, the influence of, you know, there's a great, obviously there's, you know, amazing music, experimental music made in America.
I do recall when I was doing that jazz course, there was one particular teacher who was teaching a strand of improvisation, and I remember for some weeks we were dealing purely with sort of, you know, improvising with noise and non-traditional. You know, we, one time I think we just spent the whole class playing the classroom, just finding sounds from the space we're in and not using the instruments we'd brought. And I found that exciting and liberating, but I do remember the course director calling me aside and asking me about that class and saying, what do you think, is that, isn't that a bit weird? I'm not mentioning those, but
he was
and the director at the time was possibly wondering whether to step in and say that's not jazz, and was asking my opinion. I had nothing but positive things to say about it. I really enjoyed the class. That was unusual to even be doing that at the time.
Yeah, I think Roger is someone who should be mentioned as being a kind of visionary musician in the 70s and 80s in Australia. But like I said, the things he probably got exposed to and found by his own searching was quite limited in that. In Australia then, I think you'd probably suffering from being isolated.
Well,
now the internet does help that.
But he was very much influenced by David Hearn.
You know, maybe now a bit more about your music. I was earlier talking about Americans and some Americans sticking to their jazz conventions, and paradoxically, the next is sticking to its own rules as well, in a way, you know, to the processes that you kind of started with. I mean, in my opinion, that's great because it obviously works really nice for you. But I'm interested, were you ever maybe considering a collaboration or some deviation from the standard process you're used to?
Yeah, there's been a few approaches and collaborations we've done. We still have our basic concept, and I think the fact that the music that we're making within that concept now sounds completely different to what we were making within that concept 25 years ago shows that it's still a valid concept, that if we're hanging on to it, it's because it still works and allows us to create different music. But there have been various collaborations where we're doing a thing for the BBC with Evan Parker next week when we're in the UK, just a radio recording. We've worked with Brian Eno on a couple of occasions.
As a producer or was he?
No, as a performer. He was a big thing he envisaged, three 90-minute concerts in one day with just a short break in between, with, I think, 9 musicians total. We were basically, it was a guided improvisation, might be the best description. We were allotted a certain amount of time to be the next, and then the rest of the time we were playing in various combinations with the other musicians. We did a thing with Ned Rothenberg at the Big Ears Festival in Knoxville, Tennessee, a couple of years ago, just a one set.
I think up until this point, you know, like the Necks have really operated in quite a non-verbal sort of way. You know, in some ways, you know, the idea of saying, I've got this direction, you know, a new thing the band should try and do. I mean, although there's definitely a possibility for that happening, I don't think we've tended to operate like that. We talk a lot about the music that we've played, but we never really, you know, verbally discuss what we're going to do to a large extent. I mean, definitely not in a live situation. When we record, we have sort of headings, that, you know, big concepts that maybe, but nothing very finite. I think that's because part of the philosophy of the group, as I see it, is that, you know, it's the trust that's built up and the way the music informs itself that we allow to lead the band in whatever direction it's going in. And I think that has some kind of bearing on the question in terms of, you know, how do we, you know, if we go about sort of planning to do things differently. Now, I'm not saying that won't happen, and I'm sure, you know, I think it possibly very easily could happen. But I think up until this point, we've tended to just allow things to unfold as they would, you know, naturally, just the three of us playing together over 25 years and how that's, you know, that goes where it's going to go.
Mm-hmm. And also the thing with the Necks is, if people are collaborating with the Necks as a body has a, I mean, we don't really deal with compositions, but we deal with kind of the processes we use to manipulate the material, if you like. And so to collaborate with the Next, then we are, in a sense, up until this point, anyway, we're going to play like the Next, because if people are collaborating, I mean, there's two ways you can think about it. If we are asked as the Next to do a collaboration, or we're asked as Chris, Tony, and Lloyd to do a collaboration. And I think mostly when some people ask to, you know, to do something with the Next, well, we're going to engage with the dynamic and processes that we use as the Next to play with them. Like, for instance, next week we're playing with Evan Parker, but I don't think it's going to be like the three of us playing as individuals and Evan in a context of normal kind of free improvising setting that might happen, because it's been discussed as being the Next playing with a guest or with Evan Parker as a collaboration. So they're two very different things, and I think that's quite an important aspect. But the Brian Eno thing, I felt like we weren't actually the Next from a lot of that music until it was sort of like, as part of the whole evening's music, there was a bit where it's like, okay, now the Next. But then other than that, we were kind of three of the nine musicians involved in the collaboration.
You know, I read the review of your new album, Open, a colleague of mine wrote recently, and one of the things he said in a sort of introduction was also probably because of the general praise that the Next get at our station, was that there are basically just two categories for the Next albums, the memorable ones and the exceptional ones, you know, and you've recorded 17 albums so far, so I imagine you like some better than others. Tony, you were saying earlier something about that you're proud of particular records. What sets, for you, what sets some of your albums apart from others?
For me, I think if we've set out to like sort of push the boundaries of what the band does and kind of be very specific in an aesthetic kind of endeavor, I think I'm just now I'm thinking of Ether, which I think we experimented with using sort of space and sound in a different way and sort of structures of cyclic movements in a way we hadn't done before, and I think it was pretty successful. And I think Mosquito from the double album Mosquito See-Through is another case in point where just playing a different sort of way of looking at and incorporating different approaches and different material without diluting the idea of what the Next is, and I think we achieved those things in that record as well. So I think that for me, those are the records that stand out. Other records that, I mean, I'm very happy with all our records, but for sometimes some of them stand out. Maybe it's just time and context and place.
Last one question: do you have a common favorite in the Next album? Do you agree on what are the best?
My personal favorite is Ether. I just wanted to say back on the previous question that one that really stands out for me, and it's a long time ago now, is Silent Night. That whenever I listen to that, I almost feel like that's not the Next. It sounds so different in some ways. I still have trouble understanding what sort of a headspace we were in when we did that, because it really, I really admire the difference that sound has.
Which track?
Well, particularly White, actually. Black was the more conceptual one. But I listen to White and I just think, I have no idea how he came up with that music. And the sort of offhand way I describe it is, it sounds like we're all on drugs, and we weren't, because we never use any kind of artificial stimulants to guide our music. But that's actually how different it sounds to me. It actually sounds to me like we're on drugs.
White is one of the ones that we've often talked about doing that thing of like recording in the studio like a live piece and then overdubbing. Mm. And White was kind of like,
that's
the first
exactly
time we did that.
Yeah.
That's exactly what we did.
It just sounds quite unlike us in some ways, and I really like it. Yeah. But Chris, I'm sorry. Yeah, Ether is my personal favourite. That's the one I'm nominating.
I like Mosquito.
Actually, that might be, ask us again in a couple of years, we might say Open. Silverwater also, I thought that was...
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit early to talk about.
Probably my favourite one.
Rock Jungle, I think we achieved something pretty different.
Okay, so this is it from me. Thank you, guys.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Takole so se pred njihovim koncertom, tale pretekli tork, razgovorili Avstralci The Next. če ste koncert zamudili, verjetno boste imeli priložnost spet čez kakšni dve leti ali pa tako, glede na to, koliko fenoma je pri nas. Tudi torek je bil zelo lep razpoložen v Šiški pa veliko ljudi. Če ste zamudili koncert, si lahko recenzijo preberete tudi na naši spletni strani. To je pa Mizeriš intervjuja za danes vse. S Nexi sem se pogovarjal, Goran. Lep pozdrav.
Intervju Radija Študent.